What I want to talk about today is the background, is the kind of the first in a series on history. Now, I'm going to do this new UU, or newcomers orientation group, after services and the community room, and I'll talk a little about Unitarian history and Universalist history back in the 18th and 19th century. But today, in the worship service, I just want to talk about the 20 years between 1946 and the founding of this fellowship in 1967. And it was during that year that, well, in 1946, at the close of the 1945, at the close of the Second World War, half of the Unitarian churches in the United States were east of the Hudson River. Here's the joke about the Fatherhood of God, the Brotherhood of Jesus, and the neighborhood of Boston. And in that situation, and a lot of interest in Unitarian Universalism, a radical new kind of outreach was established, and it's the Fellowship Movement. And in 1940, at the end of World War II, there were no Unitarian congregations. An awful lot started in those 20 years. So that's what I want to talk about. After the Second World War, what turned out was that the American Unitarian Association was very short of money, and they were short of ministers. And President Frederick May Elliott and this minister at large had this guy who was kind of the Church of the Larger Fellowship prototype. He would write letters. He was a letter-writing minister named Lon Ray Call. And they proposed a radical solution, which was basically lay-led groups. And they said, well, you know, this isn't so weird. I mean, the early church had all these back in Palestine and Asia Minor and Greece across the Mediterranean. They were home churches or house churches. And during the Protestant Reformation, the same thing, out of which the whole dissenting tradition emerged, they had non-established churches that would kind of hang out. And it was dangerous sometimes. And read the Bible. Look out. You'd get in trouble. And not only that, I mean, right in America, there were examples. The Quakers have no there are Quakers like President Nixon was a Quaker. And there are some Quakers that have ministers, but the Friends Quakers, Meeting House Quakers, don't have ministers. Jehovah's Witnesses don't have ministers. And even in the Unitarian tradition, Joseph Priestley, the great chemist, left England, came to the United States, and established in the 1790s house churches in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, and other areas along the Delaware Valley. And in the 19th century, Quentin Shin was a Universalist who set up little churches all over the South that were lay-led. In fact, my great-great-great-grandparents, you've heard me say I'm a sixth-generation Universalist, my great-great-great-grandparents were converted to Universalism in the hills of Susquehanna County, Pennsylvania, by George Rogers, who was this kind of wild evangelical Universalist of the era. So anyway, in 1945, they found themselves in a situation, and they created a fellowship office at the American Unitarian Association, and they hired a guy who was an advertising guy, who was a member of the Needham Massachusetts Church. And so Lon Ray Call, this minister, and Monroe Husbands, this man, became the primary evangelists in 20th century Unitarianism. And here's what they do. They gather, like in Anaheim, they get names of people on the Church of the Larger Fellowship who were in that letter ministry thing, and then they would also run ads in the paper, the Orange County Register or whatever, Unitarianism, anyone? And they say, we're going to meet at this occasion on this place. And so if there's interest, you know, blah, 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 and then people would come, and maybe if they had enough interest, they would start a congregation. In the first one they started was in Boulder, Colorado in 1946, and quickly in Beaumont, Texas, Spindletop, where there was an oil patch there, and Asheville, North Carolina, San Gabriel Valley, Ames, Iowa. Generally, the outreach was out west more than back east, and college towns were very frequently selected. There were other ways congregations came into being, spin-offs. Like in Washington, D.C., almost all of those congregations around Washington were spun off from All Souls Church in Washington, D.C., with A. Paul Davies was this very dynamic minister. And people would come in, and then it was too far to drive. Washington burgeoned, and so they started in Bethesda, a couple in Oxon Hill and Silver Spring and Fairfax, all over. And then there were splinters where there was discontent, which actually had something to do here. I've heard this story that people just felt that the Anaheim group was too political. And somebody else said, oh yeah, Timothy Leary came and it was just too trippy for me. So in any case, there were different ways that congregations were gathered. But this guy Monroe Husbands was more than anybody in Lonnery Hall. They were the Johnny Appleseeds of Unitarian Universalism in the mid-20th century. Now, so they would start a group. You only needed 10, you know, where two or three are gathered in my name. Well, Unitarians, you needed 10. And they had, and some of the issues, suitable space. You know, you would rent a space, you'd start with not much money, with a lot of young families who had money. And so you need to rent a space, and there's some issues around religious education, start a program from scratch. A lot of these fellowships had more children than adults, too. Think their 50s, you know, Dr. Spock gone wacko. And there were children everywhere, and a lot of these congregations just were sometimes the tail wagged the dog. And then worship services, well, I'll get more into that, but that could be an issue right there. And nevertheless, in the 20 years following the establishment of that office, we got 600 to 800 fellowships were founded. Now, you can't really understand the fellowship movement without getting a handle on fellowship culture, remnants of which exist here. So let me name it. There were a couple of very good things about the fellowship movement. Number one, lay empowerment. And number two, openness to innovation. Our congregations that were lay-led just were dynamic and creative and new forms of everything. One of the liabilities, I would say the biggest one, was a culture of freedom from as opposed to freedom to, if you can get what I'm saying. Too often, fellowships define themselves by what they were against. Well, we're not Christian, you know, and we're not this or that. And we don't believe in ritual, for instance. Now, in the 19th century, Ernst Troeltsch was this German sociologist, and he wrote about churches and sects. A church is a sect that's kind of gone mainstream, that's matured. I mean, the Mormons were a sex cult. Now they're a church. They're very big, you know. They're established. It was a cult, but now it's not. Now, cults usually exist on the extremes, too, is something. So, like I said, the Mormons, the Witnesses, Christian Scientists, now they start out, anyway, on the extreme. Scientology, Wicca, can be thought of as kind of extreme. And their controversy about giving them any kind of, mainstream recognition. Sects usually withdraw from society, like those, you know, reconstructed Mormons in West Texas, to remain pure. Or they evangelize aggressively, like the Witnesses that come back all the time. So Unitarian Universalism, essentially what the fellowship movement was, or you could define it, you could make the argument that it was essentially Unitarian or American Unitarianism sponsored a sect within an existing church. And gave it free rein. And it worked. It didn't always work as well as it might have, but as a general model, it worked great. Now, and why? Well, many people were attracted to Unitarian and Universalism as the Fellowship movement went on. We merged with the Universalists. And in particular, people were attracted to fellowships who were looking for institutions where they could practice public virtues. I mean, where you can, like, good citizenship and, cultural inclusivity. These are impossible to practice by yourself. You need to have others to bounce off of and to, be in community with, be in covenant with, to hold these ideals up and then try to live by them. Now, there were four kind of elements of fellowship culture which I want to talk about. First of all, worship style. Even the word worship was problematic. The fellowship tended to be very intellectual, highly intellectual, very left lobed, not much music, no candles, no chalice. I mean, the first time I went, I was ordained by a fellowship, and the first time I went, it was a lecture on orthomolecular psychiatry by a doctor, and he talked for half an hour, and then he took questions for half an hour, and then there were announcements, and then it was over. So that, you call that a worship service, I guess, but over time, certain other elements were added that were more, that were less than only appealing to the intellect. There were also certain issues in the worship hour. The passing of the collection plate was usually about a 2-year fight over, are we going to do this or not? Or how do you? And the talkback, which, John had talkbacks. I'm not bad at talkback. The reason I, 2 years from now when you go looking for a minister, you're going to be trying to appeal to, there's an awful lot more younger ministers, and none of them like talkbacks. So if you don't have talkbacks, you're going to get more interest in your congregation. But if you want talkback, I can do it sometimes. All right, so worship was one part of fellowship culture. Now I'm going to say it because I'm quoting Holly Ulbricht and how she described this second element of fellowship culture, which she calls flat earth humanism. Ministers sometimes talk about Shiite humanism. And kind of a fundamentalism of the left, almost, that rejects other theologies. And we're not that bad anymore. But in the 70s, my first congregation had been a fellowship back east, and Bob and Lois Welsh, bless their heart, the most wonderful souls, but every Sunday, that I came to paying attention to who they were talking to. So they would talk to new people, and they would tend to come up and say, well, nobody's so shallow as to believe in God who's a member of this congregation. We're so glad you're here, Well, and the issue is not that there weren't people who believed that way, but that not everybody believed that way at all. And so it's taken time. I think the mid-80s, it's another sermon, is really when that began to really shift with the adoption of our 7 principles and 6 sources, that he began to recognize that we're a pluralistic faith, and that ministers need to have facility with many languages of faith, humanism for sure, but also naturalistic theism, liberal Christianity, Buddhism, world religions, you name it. So, when I say this thing about flat earth humanism too, I think one of the kind of things I like to say that helps make it clear, some of our members, some of the fellowshippers in particular, rejected the whole idea of religion. But here's the thing. Unitarian Universalism is an alternative religion. But we're not an alternative to religion. Okay? And many of the fellowshippers, or a significant minority, a vocal minority, we were an alternative to religion altogether. But that's not our tradition. Now, the 50s and 60s was a big clash between autonomy and authority anyway, and that was acted out a lot of our congregations. But by the 70s, our movement had recovered its respect for the sacred, I guess you could call it, the transcendent, and for expressing dimensions of being other than only intellectual. But remnants remain. I was just on retreat, and I was talking to the minister in Las Vegas, and they still have these Friday night forums there that have gone on for 35 years. But nobody calls them the forum. Everybody calls them the Friday night fights. Because it's just a debate. I mean, you know, there's this group says this, and this group says, and how can you be so dumb, and what's the matter with you? And in Athens, Georgia, one of my friends went and took that fellowship, church still calls it a fellowship, and they, during his ministry, they switched from the 9:15 and the 11 o'clock services switched. So what had been the forum was meeting, like the fellows who meet out here. They said, well, no, we'll just, that'll be the big one, and we'll have the littler one that's spiritual in the morning. Anyway, so that happens. A third issue in fellowship culture was this ambivalence about newcomers and growth. The little church in Danbury that I went to, that had been a fellowship for many years. It actually had an old history, but it had been lay-led for 15 years before I arrived. They would, on Route 7 there, every day a 250,000 cars went, you know, 125,000 went down south into the morning, 125,000 every day. And they wouldn't put a sign up that said Unitarian Church, you know, quarter mile to the east, because it's these Yankees. You know, well, if they don't know who we are, they shouldn't, you know. I mean, I said, yeah, you can't even put up a sign out front that says not accepting new members at this time. Anyway, so there was this ambivalence about growth, and there was an attachment to the small size and intimacy, and you can see why. Everybody knows each other and they love each other, but it also, it's a struggle, because then you get burnout. And then there's also another problem, or tends to be, is the resistance to the changes in financial responsibilities that come with, you know, finances. People have to step a pony up if they want to have, you know, deal with it, other than just this one small group running everything. Unitarians, we don't proselytize, but we have an obligation to welcome the stranger. And I believe, that religious faith is not a private matter. And so even if we don't evangelize, I feel we have an obligation to be forthright about our faith and to say, you know, this is a good thing in my life, and tell your friends, you know, I'm not trying to beat you up, I'm trying to testify, if you want to use that word, I'm just trying to tell you, you know, this is important to me. I think you might like it. And that's hardly evangelism. And the fourth part of fellowship culture that can be problematic is attitudes towards clergy. Because we have a strong libertarian streak in our tradition. And come-outers, as we say, people who join our movement, often are reacting against an authoritarian clergy person in their past. You know, it was a Baptist minister, rabbi, a Roman Catholic priest, and many of the fellowshippers had never even met a Unitarian minister, but they were opposed to ministers anyway. So that could be a problem. And then another problem that happened, a lot of our fellowships, they did a backdoor minister. So they'd establish a little church like in Indiana, Pennsylvania, that I served. It's a sweet little group. And Indiana University of Pennsylvania is part of the Penn State system. A lot of the artists, like Fullerton, a lot of the artists and musicians are there. And the faculty members of the congregation were great. But they had hired a guy who was a Methodist minister who taught at the university. And he got kind of in there. And he served there for 28 years, kind of quarter time. So he didn't have that evangelical energy. He didn't. And that happens. And then he was a good guy. So what are you going to do? So that would happen. And then finally, another thing would happen, which I want to warn you about. Finally, you hire a minister, and a full-time minister, and you expect that person to do everything. And so sometimes they would come, and he would just get hammered, you know. And, And the other joke is, well, every fellowship crucifies its first minister. So when you become a church, well, then the issue, what do? Building or minister? I mean, you become a fellowship, where are we going to have a building, or are we going to hire somebody to help shepherd us? With the ambivalence around clergy, a lot of times the building won out. But that could be problematic, too, because it's hard to... Anyway, it's hard to do both. One very successful program, they had a minister on loan thing that happened in Santa Fe, where a congregation, and in that case, in Massachusetts, one of the congregations, just paid the guy's salary to come for 6 weeks and evangelize and get Santa Fe ready for a ministry. A couple of years later, they had. And that happened a lot of places. It was a good thing. 45 years after the end of the fellowship movement, 40% of the fellowships that were established survive to this day. And about half of those have grown beyond fellowship status. Half of the congregations in the Pacific Southwest District were fellowships. Now, it's worth keeping in mind that many of the issues congregations born in this era are systematic. So, when I say that, it's like, so when I look at some of the stuff we're struggling with, I can say, well, it's kind of textbook. And I know that feels like, well, you're just looking at us as a program, or, you know, rather than as us as individuals. No, I mean, I try not to do that. It's a good criticism. I would be careful that I don't, but I try to be careful, too. But many of the issues that our little long-time lay-led and strongly lay-led groups have, part-time group ministers have, are kind of systemic, and you don't have to reinvent the wheel. But think about this. This congregation was established by some very impressive people. They intentionally, and I'm going to talk to this next month, and they very intentionally reformed as a church, not as a fellowship. And they wanted to be a little more, grounded, a little more traditional, is that it? A little less far out, not big on Tim Leary. So that, in a way, is a good thing. I mean, it's an element of intention and focus that I really admire. And where we are today is the result of thousands, hundreds of thousands of hours, and many gifts of members' physical and financial resources. About a month, as I said, I want to pick up our UUCF story by sharing some of the harrowing and some of the not-so-harrowing adventures of this congregation's early vagabond years. And my efforts will be made that much simpler with all of your help. Please go after services. We have our reception today. It's over in the Conde Cave, this room beyond the community, deep into the catacombs of the synagogue. And when you get over there, there's a timeline around. And you can put in things you remember about the congregation in a time, especially those of you who've been here a long time. I really want you to put stuff up, but others too. We joined, you know. Betty and Joe joined, you know, that's good. Fill in what you know and what is of history to you, because we're all part of it. The churches are a community of memory and hope. And the memory, how can we hope if we don't know? We don't have a solid, wholesome memory of what was best among us that we can hope to keep going and make strong. So go do the timeline. This is designed to help you all understand and truly appreciate how special and unique UUCF is, so that we can keep on keeping on with the same clarity of vision and commitment to high ideals that brought this congregation to birth 47 years ago. So may it continue. So, namaste.